I want to try to go back and review just a little of the 10th verse, because beginning there in the 10th verse of chapter 1, going all the way down through the 16th verse, there is a play on words in the Hebrew tongue. It's not clear in the English version like I would like for it to be. I sometimes wonder how we would make it clear. But I'm doing what I can to make it clear, because I'm trying to give it to you in a very simple fashion. But if we were to read it in the Hebrew, it would be much more evident than it is in our version. Now, some of the newer versions of the Bible, like the Amplified New Testament and some of the others, they have brought out some of the meaning of the words, but not all of them. Let's go back and read that 10th verse. We really begin here at verse 11, but beginning here in verse 10 down through 16, we have the extent of Judah's judgment. Now, if you look on the map over here, there's only two places that I'll talk about tonight that you can find. Let's see, I better turn a little bit. Here's Gath and the Dome. That's about the only two places you're going to see on the map, but that'll give you some idea about where it was and all of that. But Gath was a city of the Philistines. And so you have that proverbial expression, actually used by David the first time, that starts off that 10th verse, declare it not at Gath. Or I said, to put it in modern English so you can understand the play on words, don't tell it in Tattletown. Because the word Gath means Tattletown. Tell it not in Tattletown. That's literally what he said. There's a play on the Hebrew there. So I said, tell it not in Tattletown. I kind of amplified the meaning still more, but it really literally would read in Tattletown, tell it not. Because that's Israel's enemies, and don't tell them all the problems we got. Keep it quiet. And then there is really another word there, though it doesn't come out so clear, the word Akko, which means weep town. And so, don't let your grief be known. In other words, don't tell the people, don't be a weep town, or weep not in weep town. Would probably be a better way to put that. The word Akko is not seen in our version, but it is believed to be in many of the Hebrew renderings there. And then the last word you have there, Afra, or Afra, that has to do with dust. It's called Dust Town. And so the meaning there is, in Dust Town, roll in the dust. So like I said, there's quite a play on the Hebrew words here, not so clearly seen in the English. Now we'll get into the actual lesson tonight. We have three other towns mentioned there in verse 11. And most all of these towns, with the exception of two or three there, are unknown as to their site. They probably existed and may have been thriving towns in the day of Micah, but their site is unknown. Scholars have tried to determine. They're somewhere in and around Jerusalem. That's about all we know. A lot of the towns were probably destroyed in the time of the invasion of the Babylonians and others. Sennacherib, others invaded this area, and a lot of these towns may have been destroyed in some of those invasions. We just don't know. But anyway, we have in the 11th verse, pass ye away, thou inhabitants of Sepher, having thy shame naked, the inhabitants of Zaanan came not forth in the morning of Beth Ezel, he shall receive of you his standing. And like I said, the rendering here of the Hebrew, the English has done the best they can. The word Sepher there has to do with beauty. And in a manner of speaking, he's saying that the city of beauty will be clothed in rags. There's going to be a great contrast. That's what he's pointing out. So in the 10th verse, he said, don't tell it to our enemies. But now he's saying, in Fair Town, and incidentally, that's what the word Sepher means Fair Town. Like I said, the site of it's unknown. But the inhabitants will go into captivity. They will be taken by the enemy. They'll strip their clothes off. They'll be naked. So the town that had all the people with beautiful clothes on will either be without clothes or be in rags. They'll be in shame and they'll be in nakedness. That's all going to happen there in Fairtown, F-A-I-R, Fairtown, in Fairtown, it's not going to be so fair when the invaders come. And there's a play there on the word. The beautiful clothing will be removed by the enemy. It's probably the primary thought there. Fairtown will become naked and shame town. And that's what the prophet is saying. Then we have the next word there, Zaanan. It has a meaning there of flocks and population. It was a town known for a lot of flocks, and a lot of people live there from what we read in the Old Testament. But it's not going to be able to have any sympathy out of its nearest neighbor. Now, the word means flock town or march town. You know, you'd march a flock out, and so you can see how that flock town and march town, the meaning in the Hebrew is very similar. But it probably would be best for our understanding to call it march town, like you march forth. The word literally means to come forth, to come out. And so the citizens of march town could not march out because they would be surrounded by the enemy. So in march town, you couldn't march. That's what he's saying there from the Hebrew. It's under siege by the enemy. Then we have the other town that's mentioned there, Beth Ezel. It would not be permitted. In other words, they couldn't go there and flee to there and linger for a time to get help because it would be no place of refuge for them. This Beth Ezel means neighbor town. Neighbor town. And so the meaning is that neighbor town will not be very neighborly when the enemy comes. And a lot of people believe that neighbor town was completely destroyed by the invaders, so that there was no place to flee at all. There was no town even to go to. So it won't be neighborly in neighbor town. Like I said, there's quite a beautiful play there in the Hebrew that we can't see in the English. And I'm trying to bring it out as best I can. Then we go on down to the next verse there. And we have another town mentioned this time. Of course, we have Jerusalem mentioned. That's the capital of Judah and all of that. But anyway, these other towns are not so easily identified, except we know they're near that. For the inhabitant of Marioth waiteth carefully for good. But evil came down from the Lord unto the gate of Jerusalem. Now, some believe this is referring to an invasion under Sennacherib, or Sargon, or some of the others, but I think it probably had reference to the Babylonian captivity, the invasion of Babylon, because that's when the city of Jerusalem was destroyed. So I think it probably fits better with that time, though some of this may have happened to some degree prior to that time. Now, the word Maroth there means bitter town. Means bitter town. And so I guess the thought is, bitter town will wait in vain for tidings of good. In other words, in bitter town, there's going to be great bitterness of soul. It'll be properly named. It's going to become bitter town, just like they call it. People there will be very bitter because of the invasion of the enemies. And even the city of Jerusalem will not escape these invaders that are to come. But I want you to look back at a statement there that would be very alarming to a lot of people if you didn't believe in the doctrine of free and sovereign grace. Evil came down from the Lord. I heard a few preachers on TV not too long ago. One of them was trying to explain storms and tidal waves, you know, and all of these natural catastrophes, tornadoes and hurricanes and the like. And he more or less said that God didn't have anything to do with them. And I always wondered if God didn't have anything to do with them, how in the world they got here in the first place. I mean, I thought God was in control of everything. Thought he was running the world, more or less. And if God didn't have anything to do with storms and hurricanes and tidal waves, then how did they get here, was my question to him. But as he went on in the course of his sermon, he more or less had this idea. If anything good happens, then God did that. But if anything bad happens, then the devil did it. And so a lot of people have the idea that anything that is evil, you know, comes from the devil, and anything that's good comes from God. Now, the evil that Micah is speaking of here is not evil in the sense of sin, but it's evil in the sense that suffering is grievous to bear. This is an invading army, and I mean they're going to suffer. So it's really, sometimes what we call evil may not necessarily be evil with God. When we suffer, we say, oh, it's evil time. It's a very bad time. Well, if God said it, it may be for a good time, may be for His glory and for our good, and we ought to look at it that way. Somebody said, now, God can't be tempted with evil. He doesn't tempt any man with evil. James chapter 1 says as much. Of course it does. And God does not tempt men to sin. But He certainly does allow His people to experience suffering that looks like to them to be evil. I mean, if somebody came and tore your house down and demolished everything around you, you'd say it's an evil time. But it might be that God sent it. He was sending judgment because of the sins of the people. You say, well, now, then you're going to take a position that evil came down from the Lord. That is exactly what the Bible said. So now if a fellow believes the Bible, there's no argument to it. That is what the Bible said. Somebody said, well, I never heard of anything like that. Well, it's oftentimes seen in the Bible. Go back to the book of Amos a little before the book we're studying. Look in chapter 3 and verse 6. Shall a trumpet be blown in the city and the people not be afraid? Shall there be evil in the city and the Lord hath not done it? Suffering does come from God. Not sin, but suffering. Do make the distinction there. And if the city is destroyed, it's an evil thing. But God allowed it to happen, otherwise it wouldn't have happened. He could have stopped it. He could have rained fire and brimstone on the head of the invaders. Sent an angel down to kill them all like He did the Assyrians. He killed 185,000 Assyrian soldiers in one night with one angel. But He didn't see fit to do it. These people had sinned. Their sins had mounted up to heaven and it was time to be judged. And so God allowed the evil invaders to come and deal with them. Now while I'm on that thought, I'm just going to confine myself mostly to the book of Psalms, and there are other places in the Bible I could go. I want to show you that natural catastrophes come from God. These storms, tidal waves, tornadoes and the like, all those things come from God. Because after all, He's in control of the powers of nature. Oftentimes He works that in and through the angels that carry out His wishes. But now what about a storm that comes up out on the ocean? When I was over there in the Philippines, we were there at Subic Bay and pretty near the sea. It was really a part of the sea we was in, and we had a great storm that came. And we barely got the baptizing done before the storm came. Somebody said, well, who sent that storm? The devil? No, God sent it. And He didn't send it until we'd finished the baptizing. That was noticeable also on my part. But in Psalm 48 in verse 7, look at the statement. Thou breakest the ships of Tarshish with an east wind. Same God that sent the east wind over there in the time of Jonah, all the other places in the Bible, and they destroyed the ships out in the sea, that's all said to be there from God. God is known. That's how He's known, if you look at the context there. Thou breakest the ships of Tarshish with an east wind. So storms at sea come from God. Whenever that storm came up on that ship that old Jonah was in, God sent it. The Bible made that plain. Like I said, there's other places. Somebody said, well, what about if you have a bad year, have a time of drought? Farmers don't make much of a crop, or maybe you have a wet year and everything drowns out and turns yellow and dies. Who's responsible for drought? Well, God is. Listen to Psalms 107 and verse 34. A fruitful land into barrenness. Now that's God that does all of that. Read the context. A fruitful land into barrenness for the wickedness of them that dwell therein. He turneth the wilderness into a standing water and dry ground into water springs. God does all of that. So then this barrenness of soil, this lack of production, it really all comes from God. Somebody said, what about the loss of loved ones? What about if father or mother dies? What about if a sister or a brother dies? Well, this morning we certainly dealt with that, and we know that that too comes from God. And the psalmist again says that the departure of loved ones, that too is from the God of providence. Because in Psalms 88 and 18, lover and friend hath thou put far from me, and mine acquaintance into darkness. God did it all. Somebody said, well now, what about war? That's a terrible thing. People get killed. Little kids are killed and women are killed and all kinds of people die. The land is destroyed. Buildings are destroyed. Surely you don't mean to say that the war over in Bosnia is of God. Well, if it wasn't God's will that it be over there, he'd stop it right quick, believe me. So, well, does he take pleasure in all those bad things that are happening? No. But he allows them to happen for holy ends. I'm going to show you that even war comes from God. Look in Isaiah 54 and verse 16. Behold, I have created the smith that bloweth coals in the fire, and that bringeth forth an instrument for his work, and I have created the waster to destroy. Look at that. I have created the waster to destroy. So all of the destruction of war, all of this awful invasion here, coming up on Micah and his people, it was all by the providence of God. God is in absolute control of all things that happens in the world. And oftentimes he allows things to happen to us that appear evil, but it's for our good and for his glory. These people had sinned and had to be punished. And God was going to let them be punished. But I tell you, that is a remarkable statement. Many people would hardly believe what the Bible says there when it says, but evil came down from the Lord unto the gates of Jerusalem. You know, a lot of people would like for that to read, but evil came from the devil unto the gates of Jerusalem. That's not what the Bible said. It said evil came from the Lord. The word Lord there is all capital letters, Jehovah, Yahweh. The Lord himself sent all of this evil down upon the people because of their sins. But you know, let us not just look at the instrument of judgment, but remember that God is behind that judgment. And all of these things that happen to us in this world, it is so well like the Apostle Paul said, and Christ said, they could have no power at all against us except it be given to them from above. So we have to remember that. The evil that God sends are the effects of sin, and the fruit of that is to take away the sin. That's how it was here, surely so. Then we come to another city in verse 13 there. O thou inhabitant of Lachish, bind a chariot to the swift beast. The only swift beast that pulled a chariot was a horse. Now, it doesn't say horse, but that's what it has to be. Just use your brain a little bit. She is the beginning of the sin to the daughter of Zion. For the transgressions of Israel were found in thee. Lachish will be a strong city only to flee from. In other words, it was really a fortress city. It really was there between Judah and Israel, the northern kingdom. It was more or less a protection there, like protected the frontier. And so they depended upon that city for a defense from the west. It was about 30 miles, believed to be southeast of Jerusalem, and 6 miles southwest of Micah's hometown. That one we can identify. Now, Lachish means horse town. That's what it means. Anybody knows that studied history or read the Bible that chariots were drawn by swift horses? Solomon had a lot of horses, mentioned over there in the account about him. So he's saying chariots would be bound to swift horses, not for battle, but to retreat from the battle. I guess to put it in modern terminology, we'd say they'll be horsing around in Horsetown. That may sound like a slang, but that's the only way I know to bring out the meaning there. They're going to do a lot of horsing around in Horsetown. They're going to horse around and get out of town, to be exact, because they're fleeing from the enemy. But now what's meant by the statement there, she is the beginning of sin to the daughter of Zion. Well, like I said, it was a frontier town. It was right on the border there between the northern kingdom and Judah. And so evidently this idolatry up there in the northern kingdom began to creep over down into Judah, and it came to this town first. It was the ringleader of idol worship to the southern kingdom. So the beginning of sin, it evidently was the first town to introduce image worship. And it had come into the southern kingdom down from the northern kingdom. That's why it was taking place, because it had come down from the north. Bad influence from the north had come in to the south. There's a hint of what that might have been. There's not clear scripture on it, but in the days of Josiah, he was trying to straighten out Judah from all the problems it had. And it had a remarkable problem. The horse was used in connection with worship of idols. Go over there to 2 Kings 23 and 11. And now he's trying to straighten all of this out. And he points out here some things, though, that had been going on if you look the way it reads. And he took away the horses that the kings of Judah had given to the sun, S-U-N. So in connection with sun worship, they had used the horse. They called it Horsetown, and they had been worshiping horses in Horsetown. So they had to do some horsing around to pick up the judgment tab. Mostly horse around, like I said, to get out of town, because the enemy was coming. And he took away the horses that the kings of Judah had given to the sun at the entering in of the house of the Lord by the chamber of Nathan-Melech, the chamberlain, which was in the suburbs, and burned the chariots of the sun with fire. Very interesting account there. And then there are some scholars that do not accept the view I have just stated, and they could be right. I'm not dogmatic sometime on this. A lot of people believe that because this was a town where there were many horses, perhaps many chariots, they said if there's any town that'll be safe from the enemy, it will be the town of Lachish. We've got horses. We've got chariots there. That's where our best soldiers are. That town will be safe if the invaders come. But in fact, they had to get on their horses and get in their chariots and get out of town, because the enemy was too great and too mighty for them. There are many warnings in the Bible about trusting in horses. Now, I'm going to tell you something here. This may be a theory. I guess that's what it is when you don't have any clear proof. But I believe that Solomon did something that brought about excessive taxation that led to the division of his kingdom. And if you want me to put it in simple country terms, he got the horsing around too much. He bought too many horses. You know, horses eat a lot of food. The result was there were so many horses in the land of Israel until it was absolutely breaking up the people to feed them. And so you had this excessive taxation that led to the divided kingdom under Rehoboam and Jeroboam. You know, the Jews were told not to have an excessive amount of horses. Seems like a strange command, doesn't it? Go to the 17th chapter of Deuteronomy. Look at verse 16. Speaking here about the king that would one day be set up over the nation of Israel. God foretold there'd be a king long before one was elected, Saul the first king of the United Kingdom of Israel. Talking about the king, though, but he shall not multiply horses to himself. That's exactly what Solomon did. If you'll go read over there in the book of Kings, he had stables and horses all over the place. Now cause the people to return to Egypt. So you know where the horses were coming from, if you'll look at that. To the end that he should multiply horses. For as much as the Lord hath said unto ye, ye shall henceforth return no more that way. Well, he was not to multiply wives, not to be a polygamist, if you read the next verse. But anyway, it seems like most of the kings did exactly what they were told not to do in the law of Moses. And so Solomon had a lot of horses. And there's still evidently a lot of horses in Lachish. Was a place where there were many horses. And so they trusted not in the Lord, but they trusted in their horses. Their faith was in the wrong thing. This morning was in the temple. Here it's in the horses that were there in the town. Now look at a few verses of scripture that you may have read and probably didn't make any sense when you read them. You thought, what in the world does it mention a horse there? It's something to trust in. Well, the horse was a great weapon of war, and the people trusted in it. Look at Psalms 20 and verse 7. Some trust in chariots, and some in horses. But we will remember the name of the Lord our God. So there were some people that trusted in their horses and in their chariots. Now let's go to Psalms 33. Look at verse 17. And horse is a vain thing for safety. Neither shall he deliver any by his great strength. Again, the warning is, don't trust in horses, don't trust in chariots, trust in the Lord God of Israel. The book of Proverbs, chapter 21, verse 31. Solomon is on the throne at this time, and he makes a statement that evidently he didn't pay much attention to. I guess he didn't believe what he preached, or he didn't believe what he wrote, if you want me to be technical. Proverbs 21:31, the horse is prepared against the day of battle, but safety is of the Lord. So these people were trusting that the horses and the chariots would save them. And the judgment of God was that instead of mounting up their chariots and getting their horses to go out, they would be getting in these chariots to get out of town as fast as they could before they got killed. So in horse town, they'd have to horse around and get out of town quick. That would be their judgment. And then we come on down to verse 14, and we have mentioned here, actually we're getting to the part now that is interesting to me because of certain statements there. Let's read the 14th verse that talks about presence cannot aid against the invaders that are coming. Therefore shall thou give presents to Moresheth Gath. The house of Akzab shall be a lie to the kings of Israel. Now this word, Moresheth, and it's actually Moresheth Gath. It's a word that's put together like. And what it was, Moresheth at one time was a part of Gath, and they split the cities apart. But a lot of times it was called still Moresheth Gath, because at one time it was all the same city. I don't know, I would just conjecture it being a city of the Philistines that the Israelites moved out and moved out to this Moresh and left the enemy back in the other part of town. I can't prove any of that, but it would be a sensible way probably to explain what happened there. But this is probably the hometown of the prophet. If not, it's probably the other town mentioned in verse 15, but I'm more inclined to believe it's probably the one, this Moresheth Gath. That's why I said, tell it not at Gath. I mean, he lived very close. It was almost the same towns joined together there. But this word, Moresheth, it means a parting gift. Like if your daughter got married, you'd give her a gift, you know, when she got married. Or if somebody would come to see you, you know, they're going to go off on a long trip, then you'd give him a gift, you know, before he left. Like Brother Bernardo, we've given him some gifts to take back home to his wife. It was a parting gift. That's what the word means. And so Judah was going to give a lot of gifts to the people that would be left in the land because they were going to be deported as captives of the enemy. And so I guess you'd call it gift town, if you want to be technical. But in gift town, they're going to give away a lot of gifts. Strange that wicked men will employ almost any means except seeking God when they get in trouble. They'll give gifts. Maybe they sent the gifts over there, hoping some of the Philistines there maybe might help them out or something. I don't know. I wondered why they'd do that. But the word Moresheth, some say means parting gift or gift town, or it can mean possession. That's another possible meaning. And so if you give it that secondary meaning there, thou shalt give up possessions to the city of possession. So the play on words would be seen in that respect. And really the word a lie there, the meaning of another Hebrew word is just translated. There is a play here on two words. There is the word akzab, and then the word akzab. Just a slight difference in the spelling there. One of them Z-I-B and the other one Z-A-B. And so what it is, you have the meaning of false spring. And so false spring was one that gave water in the spring and then dried up in the summer when you really needed it. We've got fresh water springs around here that do that sometime. So Akzab means false spring, and it would become Akzaba, a deceitful or dried up brook. In other words, there wouldn't be any water in it. So in Watertown, there wouldn't be any water. I guess that's the meaning of that. Let me show you the type of spring that he's referring to. Go over there to the book of Jeremiah, chapter 15, and look at the 18th verse, and you can see there what I'm referring to. Why is my pain perpetual and my wound incurable, which refuses to be healed? Will thou be altogether unto me as a liar and as waters that fail, or waters that be not sure, the Hebrew is there. So in Watertown, there wouldn't be any more water. That's the play on words that we see there. Then we come to other cities. Like I said, most of these are hard to identify. Dullam, of course, we do know. It is on the map there. We come to this 15th verse, and we're told that even the distant cities of Meresha and Adullam would not escape the invaders. Though they're very remote, they're frontier towns, they are not going to escape. Even those towns will be under attack. Yet I will bring an heir unto thee, O inhabitants of Meresha. He shall come unto Adullam, the glory of Israel. Now this Meresha and Adullam, of course, are the frontier towns, like I told you about. It means heir town. H-E-I-R. So the heir will come into heir town. The conqueror will come in and take possession of this town as if it was his inheritance by right. And so the heir would come to heir town. That's what the prophet's bringing out there. Adullam primarily was a place where the wild beasts stayed in a cave. Some say the word means the wild beast cave. Others give it a different meaning. We know from 1 Samuel 22, 1 and 2, it was the place where David fled when Saul was after him for his life. And he spent some time there. Matter of fact, a lot of people came to be his friends. About 400 soldiers gathered with him there around this cave of Adullam. If you'll go back and read there, 1 Samuel chapter 22. But the thought seems to be, the more I study it, is people of all ranks will be forced to take refuge in a cave like David did when he fled from his enemy, Saul. Now, there's a practical thing here, and that is great distances cannot exempt from God's judgment. People, you know, say, I'm going to get away from God. Where are you going to go? That's a funny thing, isn't it? So, well, I'm going to take the wings of the morning and go to the uttermost parts of the sea. God will be there. Say, I'm going to go up into heaven in a spaceship, go way up high, way up toward the moon. I'll get away from God. No, God will be up there too. God is omnipresent. So great distances cannot exempt from God's judgment. God will seek people out and he will chastise them because of their sins, and there's no putting it off so far as God's concerned. And then we come to the 16th verse. We have universal mourning as a result of all these towns being destroyed. That doesn't mean very much to us when we read this, but you have to remember that this man was talking about all the cities around him being destroyed. It would be like me standing up here tonight and say, whenever God judges this state of Mississippi, he's going to destroy Mantachie, Fulton, Tupelo, Amory, and on I'd go. Verona, all these towns. I mean, he was talking about his friends and his neighbors. And he was talking about his own hometown in one of the statements there. My own town's going to be destroyed. So, I mean, that was a very serious thing that he was talking about. And so we have the time of mourning. The mourning Jew is seen here, certainly in verse 16. Make thee bawl and poll thee for thy delicate children. Enlarge thy baldness as eagle, for they are gone into captivity from thee. Sounds as if some of the people would be left, though their children would be taken away. It was a custom among the Jews that if a terrible thing came, they would shave off their hair. Now, it was prohibited. Deuteronomy 14 and 1, Leviticus 19:27 prohibited them from doing that, but they did it anyway. It was really a heathen custom. They would shave their hair off, and then they put on sackcloth and put ashes on their head. Sometimes they'd shave their beard off. That was another practice they had. And so shaving the head was a custom of mourning. But it wasn't one they got from God. They borrowed it from the heathen Canaanites. And God seemed to never be able to get it out of their system. Somebody said, well, now, why would he talk about bald there? We've always heard of the bald eagle. Well, actually, what's called here eagle We probably, had we gone over there and were to see the creature, we'd call it a vulture. But you can call it an eagle. Probably that conveys the idea to us over here, have some knowledge of eagles. So their baldness here is compared to the eagle. And our eagle has feathers all over its neck, up on top of its head and all of that. But this vulture of Palestine didn't have any feathers on its neck and on its head. It was a bald vulture. And so he said, you're going to look like this bald-headed vulture. You're going to have all your hair cut off. You're going to be in mourning. And you're going to look so bad, you'll look like the bald-headed vulture or eagle of our country. Then I looked for a long time and wondered what he meant there when he said, thy delicate children. A lot of times they would take the younger people away captive, leave the old men, the old women. They weren't any good anyway to take them off and try to deport them. A lot of them might die in the journey, so they just left them behind. They'd leave real small babies. They'd take, shall I say, teenagers and people in their 20s. Daniel, I mean Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, they were such people when they were taken away. Went over there and they trained them in the palace of Babylon and all of that. But thy delicate children, I assume that's the choice young men and young women of the nation. They'll be taken away captive into Babylon, like many of them were when the invasion came. And said they are gone into captivity from thee. I suppose if Daniel's father and mother was alive, they could have said that about him, because they took him away into captivity into Babylon. Delicate children, children of delight, as the Hebrew has there, was probably the people, the choice people, young boys and young girls in all these towns had been taken away to Babylon, taken away by the invader. And so that's why they've cut their hair off and they're in great state of mourning, because the judgment of God has fallen upon them. But I say again, there's the most beautiful play in the language in the Hebrew here that probably has ever been seen. If somehow, some way, we could render it in modern English, it would be beautiful. I have thought about some way trying to do it. Only one scholar has even attempted to do it in his commentary, and I did the best I could to bring out the meanings there. But I certainly will remember the statement there, tell it not in Tattletown, and weep in Weeptown. All of those fit right in good with what was going on there. So we tried to bring out the meaning of those words as best we could. Let us stand, and we shall sing at this time.